Where the Red Fern Grows,
mm-hmm.
tremendous book. That's how they trapped that first raccoon in that book that they used to train those puppies, those little hound dog puppies. Mm. They drove nails into a can and put, I think, a ball of tinfoil at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And the raccoon could pull his hand out if he let go of that ball.
They won't.
But they won't.
Right.
So their greed or their commitment to it, that's what keeps them in place.
Right.
And I think of that as a metaphor for a lot of things in people's lives, mm-hmm. right? You think that you're stuck. You think that you can't get out of that thing that you're in.
Just let go.
But you got to let go.
Yeah.
And then you can move on.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast.
In the United States, there are about 15.2 million hunters. That's how many hunting licenses we sell in the country. And they spend around $21 billion per year, which breaks down to an average of $2,800 per hunter. Now, we need to be really smart about how we spend that money. You can't spend it on stuff that's going to break. Otherwise, you have to buy something else again, and you end up costing yourself even more. We also need to be smart about how much weight we carry in our packs, because that's a serious limiting factor. One way to remove about 5 pounds out of your pack without sacrificing your ability to find animals is to get rid of your spotting scope and tripod. Now, there's a time and a place for those things, and I carry both of them a lot. But if I need to go lightweight, I'm going to carry stabilized binoculars. And the best stabilized binoculars I have ever used are from Sig Sauer. They are the Zulu 6, and they just came out with a new pair called the Zulu 6 HDX. I use the 12 power magnification model. They weigh 21.5 ounces, and they have two modes of stabilization. So you throw the lever forward once, and that's going to stabilize the image. If you turn it off and turn it back on again, that's going to stabilize it even more. And I'm not kidding. It is more stable than if you're glassing from a tripod. It is absolutely incredible. You're going to be able to see stuff at just incredible distances and really break it down. Like, you're going to be able to tell the difference between a billy and a nanny mountain goat at a mile. You're going to be able to actually see if there's a kicker coming off that 4x4 muley that just popped up over the hill. They work great at early and last light. They work great at high light. They fit really well in my hands. Like, this was one of the first products that I asked Sig to make when I started working with them. And to no surprise, they were already on it. They were way ahead of me. But this is a really good piece of gear. I highly encourage you look into it. You can go to sigsauer.com, look for the Zulu 6 HDX. Comes in a few different magnification settings, but the one that I like the best is the 12 power. Check it out. Well, I'm here with Mr. Gary Shepherd, who I met this morning at my grandma's house. And Gary, you're the first dead man I've ever talked to.
Well, it's been a short trip. This is my 1 year rebirth, the day to day.
1 year anniversary since you died.
That's correct.
So, what's it like to die?
It's no big deal.
Yeah,
it seems kind of people always ask me, what did you see or what did you experience, you know, during the time?
Yeah,
absolutely. I don't remember anything. I didn't see any bright flashing lights or spiritual deities or anything like that. But I did come up with a sense of peace. And I guess it kind of a drive to explain it the best to you, as I understand it, is a drive to do more with my life than I did the first 80 years. I just turned 80 years old. And now I've decided, well, I've been brought here back for some reason, and maybe it's time I give back from my experience to the other people that I know. I don't know where I'm going with that yet, but it seems to give me a purpose to answer your question, something I never had before. Death is no longer a threat to me. It's more of a condition of living, I don't know if it makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
There's a certain amount of peace that comes from knowing that it's not a big deal. It's what you do here is a big deal.
Yeah.
And I think, if anything in my life, it's probably enhanced my awareness of the things I can be grateful for. Not out of trauma, but because there's just more value to living in the day than there is to projecting and looking at problems in the future, or political or social or anything else. What's important is what today is enough. Mm. Today is enough. And I guess that's probably a summary of how I feel about it now. I was sitting on the porch a while ago and thinking, now, where was I a year ago? You know, I was in pretty rough shape physically, but emotionally, I think I was pretty solid. I had a tremendous will to live. I've been told that. And I think that's a higher power thing in my life that has given me the will to excel all the way through all my life. I've tried to be a super achiever. And sometimes today is just enough to do the very best I can each day. And it's kind of a short answer to a difficult question. I'm still experiencing a lot of the physical ramifications of the illness, but improving every day, a little bit at a time.
How long were you dead for?
About 15 minutes, but then I was in an induced coma for 10 to 15 days. I don't remember the exact time frame. Then I developed some other problems where my lungs filled up with blood, a severe blood problem. So that made things a little bit more challenging, and they're coming through that. And it wasn't until about the 1st of October, from July to October, that I was going to make it, whether through a week or not, because they had to quit giving me transfusions because my body was starting to reject the transfusions. And I couldn't take the blood thinners, so it was a kind of a catch-22.
Yeah.
So to even be here now is a miracle. So.
Well, I think it is for all of us, right?
Yeah, I think so.
It just, you know, sometimes something happens that forces us to acknowledge that it's a miracle.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Well, in order to have that will to live and to have that toughness that it takes to keep fighting, even when your body's given up, that flicker that was still in there, that would have to be developed, you know, not only in your genetics, but how you lived your life. So we started with when you died, and now you're back again. Where were you born?
I was born in Tacoma, Washington, 3 days after my dad was killed in the Second World War, so I never knew him. Then we moved back to Montana and lived with my mother's parents, grandparents, in Plains, Montana, and then to Missoula, Montana, where I spent most of my life. Even when I was in the service, I was back to Montana, but Montana born and bred basically, and trapped when I was a young kid and ran to the mountains. It was kind of been an outdoors person all my life.
What was your dad's job in World War II?
He was in the armor in North Africa. He was killed in Casablanca.
He was a tanker?
He was a clank-clank tanker, right.
Yeah.
He's 40-ton radio. I don't know the details of his demise, but it was apparently had to do with a vehicular accident or something. Rommel was in the area at the time, so I don't know the whole story. And the only thing I know, he's buried in Casablanca. I have pictures of his gravesite. So it left me as a war orphan, a sole surviving son of the entire family line.
Wow.
And I wasn't even eligible for the draft, but I didn't know that. So I went ahead and enlisted anyway.
Wow, really?
Well, thank God for that. But
I didn't realize that would make you ineligible.
Yeah, the sole surviving son was the title that they gave me. I didn't realize it at the time. But,
So were you drafted in Vietnam?
No, I was Vietnam era. I never went into Vietnam per se. I worked with the special forces, started with the reserve components, went to active army. I was a Mustang, came up through the ranks, was selected for the officer's candidate school when I was an E-7, and went back and got my commission in 1964 and retired out as a captain.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, captains are the best.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. At least if you've
from
had
one,
if
you've from had one some, captain to another.
I know. if you had your enlisted experience seemed to help more than the commission. So
yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I have a lot of admiration for the guys that were enlisted and got a commission afterwards. I think that they were the best and the worst of all officers. And I say the worst because some of them never seemed to be able to make the transition and understand the difference. You know, they just continued to be continued to act enlisted but with a shiny collar.
Right.
And
it didn't work very well, did it?
No. It took me a long time to understand why there even needed to be an officer corps. It didn't make sense to me for years.
No.
Even being a part of it. And we don't see that type of structure in corporations or really anything besides the military. And I was so helpless as a second lieutenant.
Yeah.
You know, I'd had good training, very good training, mm-hmm. but I didn't have any real world experience at that job.
Right.
And then to step into it and have to be the one who was responsible for making the decisions and then taking on the responsibility of the consequences of those decisions.
Very difficult.
Without job experience was really challenging.
Right.
And I had both good platoon sergeants and bad platoon sergeants. Mm-hmm. And the bad platoon sergeants really wanted to see me fail because they'd had such bad experience with other officers mm-hmm. that they just hated all officers. As a Mustang, as somebody who's been enlisted, that was never going to happen with you because, you know, you could put somebody right back in their place because you'd been an E7.
Yeah, right.
So it was a really, really tough and really disorienting job. And it honestly wasn't until I'd been in the fleet for a couple of years and picked up first lieutenant that I got some good Marines around me. I had wonderful NCOs. I had a great staff NCO, and I had some good officers around me that I could ask questions to, and that's when it really started to function. And I think that's when we became such a good platoon.
I think that's probably true. Leadership isn't learned. It's an experience. It takes, I think that what you're referring to is a leadership aspect. You can have leaders at any rank, regardless of the shininess of the collar.
Yeah.
There are leaders and there are followers. And there are leaders that can take advice and compensate for the responsibility that they have. Be flexible, be mobile and flexible. And have a common understanding and gain the respect through your ability to lead. And that's, I think, from the officer corps, that's an area that, at least in the experience that I had, was, leadership was a assumed or rank assumption thing. The minute you had a bar put on your collar, leadership went with it. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah. I really am proud of what we were able to do mm-hmm. together as a platoon. And everyone had a very important role, and everybody took responsibility for what they did. I never tried to take credit for anything good, but I was always looking to take responsibility for anything that was going wrong, because I saw myself as, you know, kind of the shield between the higher officer ranks and my enlisted guys. Like, I saw it as my job to protect them. And you know, they were doing the same thing for me. And as long as everybody had that mindset where we're all looking out for each other and trying to get the mission done, then that's when the good stuff happened.
When you got each other's back.
Yep. So you commissioned in 64?
I was commissioned in 64 at Fort Benning, Georgia.
What year did you enlist?
I was actually in 59. I enlisted right about the time Bay of Pigs hit. I was in an artillery unit at the time, and I remember I was in advanced individual training when Bay of Pigs took place, so that'll give you a time frame. They put us on a tarmac and said, here's a rifle. In those days, M1s, and said, we're going to be in there to pick you up with an aircraft, and you're going to go to Cuba. Well, it never materialized, as it turned out, but that's the time frame when I was in with the 214th Artillery Group down there. And, it was a different day and age at that time.
So when you commissioned in 64, is that when you went into Special Forces?
I was in Special Forces as an enlisted man before.
You were?
and the reserve components.
So were you there right at the beginning in 1959?
No, I was in an artillery unit. I volunteered for airborne school, went to jump school. I think it was 61. I can't remember the dates now. It's been so long ago.
So Special Forces was still a very young thing.
Oh, yeah, definitely. In fact, it was... They came to a formation and asked, first of all, they gave us tests to see who could qualify because I wanted to go into PsyOps or one of the other specialized fields. And I met all the requirements for the intellectual side of it, but they had to qualify for jump school, of course, for Bragg training and all that. And I raised my hand to go to jump school, and I raised my hand to go to Pathfinder school, and raised my hand to go to jump master school. And then I was accepted into Special Forces training. And then part of it correspondence, part of it residence. And then we had some specialized area study type training that we did specifically for different areas of the world. And then that developed into my first association. A lot of the people were mercenaries that we worked with at the time. So we were training with civilian personnel as well as military. And in isolation in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Special Warfare School.
Were mercenaries at that time professional outfits, or were they a little sloppy? What was your experience with them?
They were probably what I'd consider subcontractors.
Yeah.
They're different than they have now, but they were brought in by the Joint Command, I think, to train as cadre.
Okay.
Those areas of specialties. And some of the demolition explosive engineer stuff that we got into was definitely non-traditional.
Yeah.
Including satchel nukes and stuff like that. So
I've had a couple opportunities to do that work since getting out of the Marines. Mm-hmm. And boy, it pays a lot of money.
But
I haven't done it. I haven't done it. It's sort of, that's my nuclear option. Like if I ever need a bunch of money all at once, then, you know, I'll go, you know, put my life on the table again and see if there's a job where I can fit in. But there were guys that were contractors that I considered to be very, very professional and proficient operators. And then there's guys that just had no business being there.
A lot of the people that went mercenary right shortly after Vietnam were people that probably couldn't make it anywhere else.
Yeah.
And they found that it was a military occupational specialty, so it was very marketable, and there was a lot of money was being offered for recruiting for different organizations, and there were a lot of people took it up. They went, they're not with us any longer.
Yeah.
But,
so what kind of work did you end up doing in Special Forces?
I did a lot of operations and intelligence type work, interdiction,
Intelligence, ground intelligence, signals?
We were an intelligence gathering network.
Okay.
And we'd feed it into the mainstream. There's times that we're having a lot of demonstrations against the current war in Vietnam, and we were put in positions to gather intelligence on groups that were opposing that. That's about as far as I want to go into that.
Okay. Yeah, it's intelligence is still sort of a cloudy thing, and it shows up so often in movies and in media that I don't think civilians really know what it is. We talk about military intelligence, and I think the easiest way that I can explain it, and I'd love to be corrected if this is wrong, is that there are people in the field who gather data and information, and you know, that's typically now broken down into ground intelligence, human intelligence, or signals intelligence. And then that data and information gets moved up the chain, and then it gets analyzed and vetted. And if you get the same information from multiple sources that says the same thing, then it gets coalesced, and we can now call that intelligence instead of information. Mm. And in a perfect world, intelligence drives operations. In the real world, I almost never received intelligence that drove operations. You know, we had to be creative about what we were doing and show a lot of initiative for what we were doing. if we got intelligence, we were always thrilled to have it, but oftentimes it was old. By the time it filtered its way up and back down, then it was no longer actionable, or it was flat out wrong. Mm-hmm. And there was one time that I had a sniper take a couple of shots at me and hit my tank, hit right underneath me. I was up out of the turret. And when we got back, the guys from EOD came over to just to get some practice. They wanted to analyze the bullet holes in the tank and try and figure out what it was. And they pulled out their charts and books, and they decided that it was a 762 by 54R armor-piercing incendiary round fired from a Dragunov, which is a sniper variant of an AK-47 kind of that shoots this very, very old military cartridge. 7.62 by 54R has been around for 100 years. And I thought that was interesting. And I went to our intel guy and I was like, hey, this is what the EOD dudes said. And that guy said, well, we don't have any intel of a sniper being in the area. I was like, well, there's a couple bullets in my tank right now that are pretty strong indications that there is one. And I just thought that was really ironic. Another time we got ambushed, and my platoon got hit really hard. Several guys very seriously injured, one killed. And I found out later that Intel knew that was about to happen, but they didn't get the information to us. And I've held some resentment towards the Intel community around that, because it would have been really nice to know that we're about to get attacked by a larger force.
Right.
But I also know that doesn't fall on any one individual, that there's lots of guys that were trying that, would have loved for nothing more than for us to know that was about to happen. It, the process was just slower than the actions. Is that a good summary of what intelligence is?
I think it probably is pretty accurate.
Pretty close.
I think the difference now today, at least in the area of operations, you have less time in the communication side because of technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's still subject to interpretation.
Yeah.
I have no knowledge of that. It's been so many years since I've been away from it that I'm sure there's things that are rather interesting. A lot of times you're... PSYOPs will get involved, the psychological operations will get involved with the intelligence, and it blows it completely out of kilter.
Yeah.
The desire for what they want to have happen and what's happening on the ground is probably two different things. I was never involved at that level, so I don't really have the knowledge or the expertise to answer any specific questions on that. I think your analysis is probably pretty accurate.
Yeah. There were times that we used PSYOPs very effectively. That presented in, I don't know, ways that I can say this without spilling classified stuff, but there are ways that we could use PSYOPs to make the enemy think that we were someplace else. Mm-hmm. And what we were primarily fighting against were IEDs. And some IEDs get left in the ground armed all the time. But that's a hazard to the local population. And it's not necessarily good business for anyone to do that, although it does happen a lot. Now, a lot of them get placed in front of where they think operations are going to occur. So if they think that U.S. forces are going to a certain area, then they'll put IED bands in front of those places. And we used PSYOPs to convince them that we're going to go someplace else. They could go put their IEDs there, and then we could go around and have a safer ingress to whatever our target was. And I loved that. Like, when it works, it is such a beautiful thing. Yeah, it was splendid.
Right.
Yeah. So the special forces groups in the Army, have different areas of expertise, both in like how they function and then the geographic area that they have expertise in as well. What operation groups were you in?
We were in the 19th group, and it was basically a training type organization where we trained indigenous people
mm-hmm.
To by specific missions, but basically training the indigenous personnel to accomplish military operations. A lot of it just interdiction to communications, transportation networks, supply trains, that sort of thing. Pretty basic infantry type, low caliber infantry type.
Yeah. You know, now that's accepted as the most effective coin or counterinsurgency doctrine is not to go in and do the fighting ourselves, but to enable the locals to be able to do that for them. And I think that's where Green Berets like yourself really shined.
Well, I think that's primarily the original purpose before they got a little entangled in the later missions during the Vietnam conflict. The mission changed when they started inducting people into the forces of special operations. At one time, we were all volunteer. Mm. And after the advent of the Green Beret presentation, which is probably not in our best interest in the first place, to identify the special operations, I think the doctrine changed to some degree. I'm not sure exactly how. But the old concepts were pretty archaic at that time, and they were branching into more highly advanced warfare modes, and I wasn't involved in that at all. So.
What year did you get out?
75.
Did anyone say welcome home?
Not particularly. They didn't know what we did.
Yeah.
I did have an interesting experience. So just recently, I went up to a Native American powwow at Babb, Montana, just a few days ago, and it was a Veterans Appreciation celebration. And that the basic premise there was to welcome the troops back home. And it was an interesting concept, mostly Native American, not all, but I was invited to participate in the grand entry and to have the Native Americans during their full regalia. The warrior, welcoming the warrior, was an incredible experience. And I had Korean War veterans there, Desert Storm. We had a whole passel of old-timers and young guys. It was an incredible experience. And that was a welcoming ceremony. The whole tribal entity itself, the elders, their warrior class, and then the women and the children all circled and welcomed the warriors. It was an incredible warrior-to-warrior experience. And there was tears being shed at that one. It was incredible. We had a heavy Marine present there.
Yeah. There's a strong contingent of Native American tribes who have served in the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Throughout lots of branches, all the branches. But it seems like there's a lot of Natives that end up as Marines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of them.
I have a friend named Rich Spala, and Rich was a sniper in the Army. He's an interesting guy. He works for a gun company in South Carolina. And Rich is a tremendous musician. You know, he's more tattooed than I am, and he's an artist. He's incredibly humble. And I was talking with him the other day, and Rich said that he makes it a point to say welcome home, especially to Vietnam era veterans,
right,
because it's something that a lot of you never heard.
Right.
And I think that that's a tremendous shame.
And we were even told to travel in civilian clothes, not to travel in uniform on commercial flights.
Yeah.
One thing that we've been able to do is I'm working with an organization called Whispering Hope. It's a veterans advocacy. And we get in touch with a lot of the Native American culture at this point in time. There seems to be a lot of the people still hung out in the brush, you know, don't want to get involved. There's a lot of PTSD issues with a lot of the Native Americans, and we're just walked into the Browning thing at the Blackfoot Nation and the Salish Kootenai on the Flathead area up there, and they've invited us back. They've invited us to their ceremonies, and the veterans are starting to come out, and for some reason I'm attracting them like flies to flypaper, and we get to talk about not combat-specific things, but just living issues. And then they've got the 22 project now, the 22 suicide project that is going on. And it's just amazing the things that we're finding and able to at least participate in understanding, to exploring some of the magnitude of the scars and tissue and damage that are still being experienced by the families and those living as well as those who are gone. We went up to the miniature Viet Wall. It was up in Kalispell, Montana, and went up and supported them with food for their support personnel. What an incredible experience, the networking. The people are out there yet still suffering from the Vietnam era and others, and of course the Gulf and the rest of them. But it's the warriors of the families and the women and the survivors. It's just an incredible dynamic that exists out there to this day, and most people don't realize it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tough thing. It's a tough thing. I've had troops who've killed themselves, both while we're in service and after. It's a terrible thing, and we still haven't fully understood it.
Right.
But we're getting better at finding mechanisms both to understand and to prevent it in the future. There has been 4 people who have written to me and said that they found hope or purpose through this show that has prevented them from killing themselves.
Wow.
And, you know, there's lots of ways to measure the success of a podcast like this. That's the one that I care about.
You bet. It's about the veteran. It's not about the podcast.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's about all kinds of people, but I'm very proud that, you know, there have been a couple people that heard something or learned something through this that was able to keep them alive. I don't know of anything that could make me more proud.
That's right.
And the times that, you know, I'm busy with other stuff or think that this is getting too hard or money gets tight to keep it going, that's what gives me the energy to work through it. And that's more than enough for me. I had some good friends from Browning when I was in college, when I was going to school in Dillon. There's some kids, especially that were on the rodeo team there at Dillon, that were from Browning, and they're fierce. They're awesome people. And, I knew that there are friends that would go to the wall for you if that's what was needed. Yeah. Tough people. So you grew up hunting and fishing and trapping. You told me that you were running a trap line when you were in third grade.
Yeah, I started trapping coyotes and bobcats.
Yeah, and that was on the edge of the Bob Marshall?
Actually, that was in the Rattlesnake Wilderness area now, called north of Missoula.
Uh-huh.
I was traveling on my bike, so I didn't have much mobility.
Yeah.
But I'd pile the carcasses in an old cabin and wait for them to thaw out in the spring, and I'd do all the skinning and stuff then. I basically ran away from home. My folks were a real dysfunctional family life, so the only solace and peace I had was to go to the mountains, and it's continued that way all my life, I think, back into the Bob Marshall and Mission Wilderness area, and fishing and hunting, and I just felt peace. That was where my sanctuary.
Earlier today, I was teaching a shooting class to some folks that are going to be elk hunting with me this fall. Came straight from that to this. And I was thinking about you and thinking about how kids in the country learn a pretty specific type of shooting that is very effective, but it isn't doctrinal at all.
No.
So when you learned how to shoot in the Army, the shooting that you'd done previous to that, do you feel like it helped you or hurt you?
The military training actually hurt my ability to react on target. It was a dish. Fixed shooting positions were out of the question in the real world. Your target of opportunity, you had to react and react effectively or not react.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you had a judgment call whether you're going to place a round where you need to place it or if you're going to make a bad kill.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. They always did quite well, you know, mastering the target shooting and punching holes in paper. But when it came to actual operational stuff, it was probably more harmful than helpful.
And then did you resort back to that shooting of your youth when it came time to do it for
real? I think
real?
You do automatically. That's ingrained in you. You just, it's a tool, and you have to use the tool. You fine-tune the tool, or you don't use it. So even today in my civilian life, when I conceal carry, I have certain doctrines that I follow if I ever have to use the tool, things that I do, and it's not based on military training. It's based on practical experience, what the tool can do and how effective it can be used. There's other ways. It's a thing of last resort.
Yeah.
But it's an effective tool if you use it properly. So, you know.
Yeah. And it can be a great way to just create some space so you can get the hell out of there, too.
That's right. Just your tactical withdrawal.
Yeah. Attacking in another direction, as the Marines would say.
Right. Tactical retrograde.
You know, I think all veterans today, the veterans, you know, of these last couple wars, we had a really good homecoming. There was such appreciation from everybody. People could hate the war and they could still love troops. And that wasn't the case for you at all. And I think that we have you to thank for that, because you took all of the hate. You took all of the hate, and you didn't deserve it. And I believe that our country eventually felt shame around that, and they sent the appreciation towards us that they should have sent towards you.
You know, I think I have a little different take on that. I think the wall in Washington, D.C. was probably a marked turning point, because when you go to that wall, I chose to go there at night, when the troops were still being presented with the boots, combat boots, and flowers and things at night next to the Korean Memorial, to realize there's 58,000 bodies represented there, the treasure and blood that was shed. And I think that the wall was a turning point, and it continues to be that way, because they have a new project now called the Living Wall, which is honoring the people from Agent Orange and some of the other chemical exposures. So I think that was probably a necessary part of our history. Unfortunately, it was a very narrow generation that took a lot of that. But I think it's nature of warfare has never been static in as far as reaction. There's so much political and animus and bureaucratic things that are involved. But when you actually see what the wall represented, I think it was a turning point in American culture. We finally had to own up to what the cost was of the conflict. I think that was the turning point, and I think that was one of the reasons we realized that our treasure and blood is worth something. And it was a physical representation, you know. I think it is a vast number of people. That only represented the people that perished. It didn't represent the 200 and some thousand others that were injured or, you know, continue to be injured to this day. So although it's unfortunate, I think it was a necessary turning point for understanding for the people in general, particularly after the conscription of the draft went on its way. There was no longer a reason for service in our country. I think eliminating the draft took away the skin in the game, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I think that had a psychological effect on the culture. So Vietnam happened when it happened, and I think it was unfortunately, a necessary thing that happened, brought about an awareness of the cost of conflict. And it didn't solve anything, but at least it changed the awareness, I think. And I think we need to be thoughtful about that.
What other lessons do you think our country learned from Vietnam?
Unfortunately, I don't think we learned enough.
Yeah.
That's my personal opinion. It's only my opinion. Is that we need to be very cautious about what we get involved in. Take care of our people at home. Special forces attitude, train the trainers and let other people fight their own battles. Unless they're an immediate threat to our way of life, and there's plenty of that at home now, then we need to take our resources and invest them more wisely for the outcome.
When did you start guiding hunters?
Well, I was kind of a self-appointed guide. I worked with the Copenhagers, the Whitetail Ranch, and the Bob Marshall, the friends of theirs. And then I launched out on my own little forays. I had my own mules for a while, and I'd take people back in the backcountry, unlicensed, you know, kind of a Mustang at that too. And then even recently in the Missouri Breaks National Monument and the Upper Missouri National Break, I was an unofficial guide to sheep hunters in there. I couldn't officially guide them, but I get to provide them base camps.
Yeah.
And provide them information of how to go about what they were doing. So
yeah,
all my life I've been involved in some part with dudes.
Yeah. when did you start seeing grizzlies in the Bob?
Actually, when I was in high school. They'd always been in there, but we had a place we'd go in through Holland Pass. That's the Sealy Swan side, and we had a place called Grizzly Basin. It was aptly named. That you'd, later in the year, there'd be a big infestation of bugs at the higher elevations, like ladybugs. Mm-hmm. And the bears would migrate up there to feed on this influx of insects. And that's where I first encountered them. I never had a problem with them. But they were... I don't think there were near as many at that time in Bob as there are now.
Yeah, there's a lot of them now.
Yeah. Well, actually, where I live now in Lincoln, Montana, we had one that was hibernating in a haystack right outside town.
Yeah.
And the wolves, of course, are the Canadian wolves that have come down now. They're a different critter than what we had used to have, but
yeah,
there's wolves right there inside of town, basically right around town.
Well, and that bear... That grizzly that dragged that lady out of her tent and killed her, that was in Ovando just a couple years ago.
Yeah, it was right next to the post office.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ovando's a wild place, Lincoln. Yeah. Yeah. But the Bob Marshall Wilderness is a spectacular place. It's pretty inhospitable anymore. You know, there's just a lot of bears in there.
Well, they also now they expanded into the Scapegoat Wilderness area, which is on the southern boundary on the Continental Divide, and that's provided more of an opportunity. And the federal land managers have closed a lot of the roads into the area, so it's lessened the pressure on the grizzly, so they're able to get in more acclimated to human population because of the proximity of they get closer and closer to, quote, civilizations. They become acclimated to food sources, so therefore there's more likely conflict. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's widely disputed by the professionals, but when you see grizzlies get a grizzly alert on your Facebook page that there's grizzlies in the North Ranch Road 20 minutes away from you, probably should pay attention.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh, what a crazy time to think about, like, you being out there on a bicycle as a third grader trapping, you know, no means of communication with anybody at all, to now getting alerts about grizzlies being around on Facebook. Like, you've seen a lot change.
Yeah, we always dreamt about having the CB radios that we'd have that heavy communication capability. That's about the extent of the handy talkies with the GMRS frequencies on them, you know. Just enough to get yourself in trouble, but... In those days, you had a lot more situational awareness. You knew what was going on. The weather was your biggest enemy.
Yeah.
And you had to respect certain things. Stay dry. Stay out of the wind. Don't do stupid stuff.
Any good stories come to mind from your times in the wilderness?
Well, one in particular, I told it earlier. Dad, I don't know if you were there or not, but I jumped a grizzly sow and a cub up in Mission Wilderness area up off of Lindy Peak, and it's getting dark, so I figured I better get the heck out of there and get out somewhere where I could control the access. If she was prone to looking for food or something, I would left some kind of a food source trail. I'd better get out to an area, and there was this place called Angel's Bathing Pool, which had a long point that jetted out into the lake with a rock point. So I figured I'd go out there and camp out at the end of that point. That way, if I did have a conflict, I know which way it was coming from. So way after dark, I felt something rubbing up against the side of the tent. All I had was a little .357 pistol with me. And I thought, hey, this is it. I'm going to have to roll out of the tent and get prepared to shoot and do the best I can with six rounds. I rolled out of the tent and looked around, and here's a porcupine rubbing up against the tent. And after my heart settled down, I thought, well, That was kind of stupid. But that's the closest encounter. Normally the grizzly, you can smell them before you ever see them. They have a tendency to bury their kill and come back and feed on it.
So, yeah, lay on it.
Yeah. They roll in it and all that sort of
nasty
things. You can usually smell them if you're in an area. If you see a lot of droppings and things, you just don't push their area. You get to stay away from it. So
it's the same thing in Alaska. Even with the brown bears, if you're very far from a river and you smell fish all of a sudden,
it's probably not your partner.
What's special about the Missouri breaks that causes you to spend time out that way?
Well, I think the most of the harshness, there's a certain beauty in an area that's so utterly unforgiving. Everything from sinkholes and sandstone formations that you just fall into and never be found, to the vermin, the rattlesnakes, to the weather itself. Once again, is a very major thing there. You can get in all sorts of trouble. If it rains there, if it's not paved, you're not a road.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a gumbo, a real thick clay type stuff, and even four-wheel drives and things, you can't navigate it. So when you're in there, you're in there.
Yeah.
And if you're in there on foot, you're at the mercy of everything. Really harsh. You either have more water than you need or none at all. And that's a long ways no matter where you go. I mean, air miles, it might be only one or two, but it might be 40 miles to get there.
Right.
Just terribly, terribly rugged. And but there's a beauty in that, too, the wildness. And even horses have a hard time getting around part of that area, so.
That Fort Peck Reservoir on the Missouri has more miles of coastline than the state of California.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, this massive waterway that is in Montana that a lot of folks don't even know about.
Yeah. It's interesting, the area that I'm familiar with is 149 miles above that, starting at Fort Benton.
Okay.
There's two ferry crossings and one road crossing 149 miles, and the rest of it's all wild. And so that's up from the UL Bend upstream. And fantastic fishing and hunting and all that, but you really got to know what you're doing to survive there.
Is that where bentonite comes from?
The bentonite is a type of clay, which is a thick, you use it for sealing different water sources and things. It's kind of we call it gumbo.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really slick when it's wet.
Yeah, I've seen where people have tried to drive when it rains out there, and that gumbo just sticks to their tires and grows on every turn.
And then you're basically immobilized.
Yeah, people break axles, rip tires off their vehicles, and it happens really fast.
Yeah.
So you just, if it rains, you're just stuck. Yeah. Have you found any fossils or dinosaur stuff out there?
There's... You can find them, but you can't collect fossils on public land.
Mm-hmm.
There are areas out in that area that, on private land, that we have found fossils, and they've been donated to different museums and that sort of thing. But I know one area out there, there's a section of vertebrae that's almost 30 feet long that I found in an outcropping.
Wow.
But it was in public domain. And a lot of people don't talk about it when they find it because it encourages people to go out and salvage and destroy it. There's a lot of Native American archaeological sites in the area as well, dating back to McKeon, Sandia, and Clovis about 10 to 13,000 years ago that are really fragile. So you don't talk about where you find that stuff.
But, right. And they've found some T-Rexes out there, right?
Oh, well, not right in the area where I'm at, down at the Hell Creek Formation.
Yeah.
The further you go down the river from White Cliffs, it's called the Claggett Formation, which is the predominant Judith-bearing type of vertebrate fossils.
Okay.
And that extends, and it gets shallower and shallower as it gets closer to Fort Peck. And at Fort Peck, you get into the Hell Creek Formation, which is the lower end of that formation. That's where they have the major of the research digs at this point in time. I think you spent some time in Hell Creek, did you not?
I did, yeah. I found ammonites there that I think were, 200 million years old or
something crazy
like that. And they had opal in them and were really, really beautiful.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's an incredible country. And every year, of course, more is exposed because of the nature of the landscape there is so rough and fragile that a major snow year, a lot of fossils are unearthed just by natural forces.
Right. Yeah. What's your favorite animal to hunt?
When I was hunting, I don't kill anymore.
Oh, you don't?
I don't. I think elk are probably my prime thing.
Yeah.
I've never drawn a sheep permit. I love them, but they're not very smart. They're just kind of like a tourist animal.
The hard thing's drawing the tag.
Yeah, the hard thing's drawing the tag, and there's a lot of ethics involved in how they do it. I just prefer not to get involved in that. But elk hunting is good meat, and particularly over in that country, I prefer hunting cows, not bulls.
Yeah.
As a subsistence hunter, I don't go after the horns. Besides, they're hard to cook and boil. So,
what do you, besides the meat, what do you like about the animal itself and how it behaves?
I like its gregarious nature, the herd instinct to watch the lead cows, to work the herd. You know, if you've ever been around elk, and I'm sure you have, being in your business, but you always watch the herd cow. And that'll tell you more about their behavior. It also prohibits you from shooting them in an area where you have to work too hard to get them out. If I can't drive up to them, I don't shoot them.
Yeah. Yeah. They're heavy.
Yeah. Oh, they are.
Yeah.
And then, of course, in the earlier seasons, the weather isn't conducive to leaving them anywhere, and you got grizzly problems. So you got to get them out of the field as soon as you can. That means quartering them up and dressing them, feeling, get them the heck out of there. And you got to blow flies to worry about. And it's a total experience. I think the hunting is more important than the killing.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that.
You asked about using a weapon earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tool. I like to make a clean kill and do it humanely and do it responsibly and know that I can get the animal's usable parts out and do it with honor. There's a certain amount of honor involved in killing for meat. I had chickens and ducks and all that sort of thing, and I have to really work myself up to butcher chickens. But when I walk into a large critter like an elk, or a bear for that matter, it's an honorable thing to do it correctly, and do it cleanly and to the best of your ability, and then maintain the quality of the food source. It's a matter of honor to do that. And the Native Americans felt that way too. They'd pray over their kills. And, of course, they were utilized more of the carcass than we do today, but it's the principle still the same.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's important to acknowledge all of that.
It's part of the, I call it dues, you pay for being out there. You have to have a certain amount of respect for the life, whether it's flora, fauna. There's a certain amount of respect you have to have towards the environment, and I think killing is a necessary part of survival, and nowadays, but you're butchering cows, it's the same thing. The point is, it's a sacred obligation to handle them with respect.
When we have cattle killed by wolves or sheep killed by coyotes, with the sheep and cattle, the people who are advocates for wolves or for bears or whatever it is that did the killing, they will often say, well, what does it matter to you that, you know, you're raising that animal to kill it? And they don't understand how much ranchers love their livestock and, you know, just dedicate their lives to making sure that that animal is living well and healthy right up until the minute that it gets killed.
That's correct. They're the best managers of the land, of the people that live on it. I have my own theory about apex predators.
Well, tell me.
Okay. They eliminated the wolf, they eliminated apex predator during the wolf hunting days.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, then times the buffalo were a plains animal, the elk were predominantly plains animals, and it was an all complicated ecosystem in its own right. But they introduced another apex predator, that's man. Two apex predators in a field competing with one another for kill, which man does. This doesn't work. So now in the process of introducing that another apex predator back into the system, throws everything out of balance. So what happens? The coyote and the bobcat and the wolf and all the rest of them feed on the most reliable food source, which happens to be the farmer's bovine type critters. And he spent all of his life supporting that critter before the apex predator was reintroduced. So now the rancher becomes the bad guy. The wolf is the good guy. And nobody talks about the man.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's an interesting concept that there's always an apex predator, but you can't have two of them in one food chain.
Well, man has been here for a heck of a long time, mm-hmm. you know. Whether it was a Native American or European settler to follow, or, you know, the dig site on the salmon over here, I've talked about this before, but they found wolverine jaw bones that they dated to 16,000 years ago around this fire. And I think this is just so interesting. The spear points that they found there, you can tell by the way a stone tool is built, who built it. You know, mm-hmm. every tribe had its own style, and the closest spear points that they found to those came from Japan. Mm-hmm. So this was before Clovis people came across the Bering Strait and started right. coming south. These would have been Japanese that came across on boats and would have went all the way up the Columbia River, up the Snake River, up the Salmon River to mm-hmm. Graves Creek. And somebody was gangster enough to kill wolverines. You know, it's incredible. But, you know, man has been part of this picture for a long time. Guns changed the game.
Yes, they did.
Guns changed the game. But I'm sure that so did the atlatl and mm-hmm. so did the bow. When I was doing a bunch of research for a film project that I did that went with a moose hunt about moose, specifically Alces gigas, the Yukon moose, I was going into it with the assumption that they were getting shot with a bow by natives primarily. And that turned out to not be true at all. Most of them were trapped or snared. Mm-hmm. And then when it came time to actually kill them, that was mostly done with a spear mm-hmm. and not with a throwing spear either. No, it was with a hand spear.
Right.
But they really liked to snare them and get them tangled up in the brush to keep them from being able to move around. You know, makes right. all the sense in the world.
Even not a lot with the dart throwing device. It wasn't a shaft throwing device. It was a reusable delivery system for darts that mm-hmm. they used on large. A lot of people don't realize that. I've even made my own attempts at making not a lot of, and I do some flint napping as well.
Yeah.
And it's incredible the concepts that we have in the textbooks of how things were used were developed from 1940s and 50s film depictions of what was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Atlatls are amazingly powerful.
Oh, yes, they are.
Yeah. You get a light dart and you can send that thing a heck of a long ways. Yeah.
Well, they have a society in Montana, this Atlatl society, that they replicate and they actually have competition with Atlatl.
Yeah. And it's legal to hunt within a couple states. I think Pennsylvania is one of them.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I had a PhD on the show years ago talking about atlatls, and he lives in Colorado, and it's not legal to hunt with them there. It's not legal to use stone points there either. But he's really interested in traditional archery and atlatls. And for those that don't know, this is a handle that you would cradle a long, heavier arrow into, and it extends the reach of your arm and provides extra leverage. And you can reasonably throw a dart over 100 yards with one. And with practice, you can become very accurate with them too. The sling is another one. You know, I used slings as a kid all the time, and it was something that I could make with a worn out glove and a couple pieces of parachute cord or leather. And man, you can throw a rock over 200 yards with just a few minutes of practice. And I always thought it was crazy in Bible school when we'd get to David and Goliath, they'd talk about what a big deal this was. I was like, Goliath didn't stand a chance. Like, this is a big, slow dude who's nearsighted, that's got a spear against a shepherd that's been killing lions with his sling. Like, Goliath loses that one every single time. He can't get close enough to him. And you get smoked in the forehead by a river rock. Yeah. I don't care how big you are. You're like, that's the end of your day. But yeah, slings are another really powerful tool. And I think it's curious that they don't show up more in sort of the survival circles, because your ammunition is abundant. You pick it up off the ground. Right. It doesn't take much to make one. You can, if you can make cordage, you can make out of lots of stuff.
And right.
Then you can make the pouch and strings, and with a little bit of practice, you can be really deadly with a sling. But another one, since we were talking about trapping earlier, now we're talking about survivalists. I see snares show up in survival kits all the time. Mm-hmm. And snares are very effective, but they're single use. You know, right. You catch one animal and it gets all kinked up and it'll never work right again.
Right.
You throw a conibear in there or a little leg hold,
right.
And that thing will work for the rest of your life.
Right.
Yeah. I think people should really consider learning how to use a conibear. And if they've got a 110 and a 220 and a 330 conibear.
Well, and they're humane as well. They're a killing trap, where your leg holds, the animals sometimes will chew out. When I started trapping, we used to trap marten. We used horseshoe nails.
Mm-hmm.
We'd drill a hole in the side of a tree and put a lean post up and put a piece of rotten fish back in the hole. And then we'd drive horseshoe nails in at three different angles of the marten and reach in with each paw to extract the fish. And then it would engage the skin.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't chew off that way. And it was lightweight, very effective. All you had to have is a brace and bit and some horseshoe nails and a way to tap them into the tree. Those, you never see those in kits either. You know?
Yeah. You know, Where the Red Fern Grows?
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous book. That's how they trapped that first raccoon in that book that they used to train those puppies, those little hound dog puppies. Mm. They drove nails into a can and put, I think, a ball of tinfoil at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And the raccoon could pull his hand out if he let go of that ball.
But they won't. Right.
So their greed or their commitment to it, that's what keeps them in place.
Right.
And I think of that as a metaphor for a lot of things in people's lives, mm-hmm. right? You think that you're stuck. You think that you can't get out of that thing that you're in.
Just let go.
But you got to let go.
Yeah.
And then you can move on.
I think that's probably true in a lot of life situations. Metaphor or not, I think that letting go sometimes is a release mechanism even for our veterans sometimes. Letting go of the old. Another thing is to say yes. Another thing is to say yes, I'll try it. I met with a gentleman that makes flutes. You're probably aware of who I'm speaking of. Native American flutes, and he's a sculptor. And he said, you know, I grew up in the South, and he says, I didn't have any fancy toys. I had to make my stick games and my little figurines and all that. And he says, I run into people now when I'm playing the flutes. They say, well, I don't have a taste for music. I don't know how. He said, well, what about the Native American? They didn't have music teachers. They picked it up and they tried it, and they found out they could make a beautiful sound with it. So sometimes saying yes to a difficult situation is the same as letting go. To say, I'll try. When I don't have a taste for music, how do you know if you've never tried? I don't have a taste for survival unless I've really tried. I've never fired a firearm in a hunting situation. I can't do it. Have you ever tried? I think that trying and letting go are very close in nature.
I like that. You know, a lot of people today will try something. They'll say yes to it and they'll give it a try. And then they'll quit if they're not immediately good at it.
No such thing as immediate gratification.
Yeah. And that's what Mark Twain said about chopping wood.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said people like chopping wood because they get an instant result.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't like chopping wood that much.
Yeah, you got to stack it, and you have to depend on it for heat.
Yeah. Well, sir, I sure appreciate your stories and your insight. I'm glad to see you alive a year after you died. Yeah. And I hope that people will hear this and understand you and the people, you know, of your units and of your generation a little bit better.
I really appreciate the opportunity to share what unlimited experience that I've had. But what you're doing is a very valuable thing, and I hope you pursue your goals. This life is too precious to let it dwindle off into the nana land of forgetfulness. There are things out there that are painful and unfortunate, but they're part of maturing socially and intellectually and personally.
Well, I promise you, sir, I'll continue the pursuit.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much for listening. I'm going to keep bringing you these stories from normal people just like you who have done extraordinary things. Everyone is an expert at something, and they have interesting perspectives on life and work and the environment and all of the things that we care about. I'm going to keep bringing that to you. And I want to thank you so much for making this show possible. I also want to thank Emily Bratcher for producing this show. She does a great job editing. Really appreciate her. I want to thank John Chatelain. He did the art for the Six Ranch podcast. And Celia, soon to be Harlander, she digitized that so that we can get it out there on the internet for you. Also want to thank Justin Hay for writing this original music and the beautiful whistling that you're listening to right now. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much. Please keep listening to the show. Write me a review if you feel like it. And just keep doing your thing, and we'll all learn from this together. It's been fun, and you know, we're just getting started.